You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Second World War. On this episode of our Spanish Civil War interview series, I was joined by Dr. Stephanie Wright, the author of Glorious Brothers, Unsuitable Lovers, Moroccan Veterans, Spanish Women, and the Mechanisms of Francoist Paternalism. We discussed the treatment of wounded war veterans in post-Civil War Spain and Morocco. We also discussed Dr. Wright's current research into sexual violence in Francoist Spain. As always, you can head over to historyofthesecondworldwar.com/interviews to find more information about Dr. Wright's works. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Spanish Civil War interview series. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Stephanie Wright, and today we're going to discuss Dr. Wright's research into the treatment and experiences of Spanish Civil War veterans during and after the Civil War. Dr. Wright, how's it going today?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm here, and that's about all I'm going to say. In Francoist Spain, during and after the war, there was an effort to recast wounded veterans maybe in a more positive light. What caused this shift in how military veterans who were disabled were treated within Spanish society, which I know was they were not treated well in pre-Civil War times?
Yeah, and actually, to answer your question, I probably need to go back and look how disabled veterans were viewed and spoken about before the Civil War. So for many years, veterans of Spain's colonial wars had been managed within what was called the Cuerpo de Inválidos, or the Invalids Corps. And that corps was part of the armed forces, and men who became part of it remained in active service. And that's quite important because it meant that they were still they could still benefit from things like automatic promotions for seniority, and that they were still considered active servicemen. So then when the Second Spanish Republic comes in 1931, they dissolve the Invalids Corps. So members of that corps still get pensions, but they're no longer in active service. They no longer get those seniority promotions. And I'm not sure whether you've discussed this elsewhere in the podcast series, but that dissolution formed part of a whole range of reforms that the Republic brought in to, and particularly Manuel Azaña, who was the war minister at the time, who brought in all these measures to reduce the size and the influence of the Spanish army, which had caused significant problems in the preceding years, but also throughout the 19th century as well. So anyway, the dissolution of the Invalids Corps during the Republic formed part of those measures, which were deeply unpopular within military circles and seen as very anti-patriotic. Okay, so what does the Francoist side then do during the Civil War with disabled men who begin to return from the front with disabilities? Do they resurrect this Invalids Corps that the Republic had dissolved? Well, the answer to that is that they kind of do. So in April 1938, so still during the war, the Franco side creates a body which administratively looks quite similar to the pre-Republican Invalids Corps. So there's a similar conceptualization of disabled men as active soldiers, and there are similar kind of cultural features. So, for example, Miguel de Cervantes, the very famous author, is commemorated as the first disabled veteran of Spain in the Invalids Corps, and he is also that way in the new corps introduced under Francoism. But there are some key differences, and the main one is the name. The corps is no longer the Invalids Corps, but rather the Honourable Corps of the Mutilated in the War for the Fatherland, which is a bit of a mouthful. Spanish is El Vermeor Cuerpo de Mutilados de Guerra por la Patria. And so those admitted were given the quite ostentatious title of Mutilated Gentlemen, or Caballeros Mutilados. And so in this sense, the Franco regime's treatment of the war disabled kind of really shines a spotlight on the interplay between continuity and kind of new elements in the regime's governing ethos. So there's a lot of continuity in the administrative structures of the regime, but also in the new corps. And when I say continuity, I mean kind of continuity with the pre-Republican period. And that's quite helpful for the regime because it brings a sense of legitimacy. So the idea that the regime is just a continuation of what was already there before the Republic, and it's the Republic that is the kind of non-legitimate part of Spanish history. But there are also novel elements which signaled a shift from what had come before that Republican period, or rather a kind of mainstreaming of certain military values which had previously been kind of the preserve of a select group of military men. So the rebranding of war invalids as mutilated gentlemen reflected the regime's emphasis on the importance of sacrifice in war, and the idea that these sacrifices were really the pinnacle of Spanish masculinity and the pinnacle of Spanish patriotism. And I should say that this emphasis on sacrifice in battle and honour was really kind of linked to the culture of Spanish Foreign Legion and the Army of Africa in general. So the Army of Africa was the Spanish Foreign Legion, and the Moroccan regular forces, which tended to operate in the northern kind of protectorate in northern Morocco, the Spanish protectorate in northern Morocco, sorry. But the founder of the Foreign Legion, a man called José Miguel Astray, who was himself a double amputee, he was selected to head up the Disabled Veterans Corps during the Civil War. So there's a very clear link between the Disabled Veterans Corps during the Civil War and the Legion and this kind of culture of sacrifice and honour. So the new kind of Mutilated Gentlemen's Corps really reflects the idea of kind of continuity of previous structures, but also the kind of mainstreaming of this kind of military culture that was forged within the colonial wars of the early 20th century, which had been very formative to a lot of the generals and the armed forces personnel who would then occupy quite a prominent position in the coup, but also in the regime, including Franco himself, who kind of cut his teeth in the African sphere as well. But also kind of broadly in terms of PR, I suppose, when the regime was trying to paint the Civil War as this glorious and holy crusade that was meant to regenerate Spain and purge it from the sickness of so-called Marxism, it was certainly a very kind of clever move to present the Francoist war wounded, to prevent them from being seen as invalids that were to be pitied. So I should say that even though men in the pre-Republican Invalid Corps were technically in active service, there was certainly a stigma around that invalid label. So the Mutilated Gentleman rebranding really helped to sidestep that stigma. And actually, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the Francoist war disabled were considered to be quite a privileged group. So their material benefits were pretty meagre, as was often the case after conflicts, all over the world. But we see a lot of cases elsewhere in Europe where benefits are pretty meagre. But Francoist veterans were treated better than a lot of people in Spain during the Civil War and in the post-war. So the post-war period, a period of extreme economic deprivation, have around 200,000 people, according to recent estimates, who die of starvation and related illnesses. So, you know, really extreme poverty. And so in comparison to those people, and also more importantly, in comparison to Republican disabled veterans who are completely ignored by the regime, Franco's veterans do appear to be privileged citizens under the regime. And that kind of duality between the two cohorts of veterans is really quite blatant. So there's, you know, the very kind of dark humour of the post-war. People used to joke about the fact that Franco's disabled veterans were mutilated gentlemen, whereas Republican veterans were just jodidos cojos. The polite translation for that is something like damned cripples. And then later, dissidents really kind of reappropriate the figure of the mutilated gentleman as a symbol of the regime and the symbol of the regime's decrepitude and decay. So it's really quite interesting. And in terms of kind of thinking comparatively with what's going on elsewhere with disabled veterans in the UK or in France, you really don't get that sense that Franco's disabled veterans are these emasculated figures that are really marginalized from society. No, instead in Spain, they are really kind of, they are clearly on the winning side of the war, and they're not viewed in that way.
Something I try to point out as well, especially coming from a modern viewpoint, especially I'm an American, many of the listeners of the podcast are Americans, you know, but elsewhere in the world, I think there's a very different view of veterans at this time in history when you look around Europe and in other places.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that these sort of disabled war veterans had kind of a privileged place in society. And I know that one of the things that one of these privileges that they had was that a certain number of public sector positions were filled by members of these groups. Was this the only way, I guess, were there other examples of sort of how these men were elevated within society?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's quite a tricky one to answer, even though it sounds quite straightforward. So yes, legislation was put in place to support disabled veterans of the Franco side, which included reserving 30% of vacancies for mutilated gentlemen in a range of sectors, but very often in the public sector. And on top of that, the regime provided pensions for the most severely disabled. So those who couldn't work were given, supposedly given pensions. There are also, there were also more kind of non-material privileges granted to the war maimed. So for example, seating was reserved for them in on public transport. They were also granted the right to skip queues in shops, which could be really important. I mean, now we're used to seeing queues outside shops, and you know, it's still a kind of thing at times of food shortages. It can be really beneficial to be able to skip the line. And also that's a very kind of visible benefit. There were also a lot of commemorative events held in honor of the Franco's war disabled. So football matches, bullfights, theater held in their honor. And so all of these kind of public displays of honouring the war maimed were really important for cementing perceptions of Franco's veterans as these favoured citizens, especially in the context where the regime had so many enemies. So people with Republican backgrounds were often purged from their jobs, or imprisoned, or forced into exile, or even killed. So, you know, within that context, all of these kind of benefits really, you know, are very striking. But then this is where a closer look at the experiences of Franco's war disabled start to kind of trouble.
I noticed you used the word supposedly when discussing pensions.
Chose my words carefully there, because I don't want to give the impression that Franco's veterans, particularly the rank and file, that they were comfortable. Because when we kind of look at what the benefits that they received actually meant, it's very difficult to. It's very difficult to view them as victors in the way that we might imagine that they were. And I think if we focus on the utter neglect of Republicans, and I just want to be clear, I'm not minimizing that at all, but if we just focus on that, then we do lose sight of actually how measly the measures were in place for, you know, even for Franco's veterans. So just to give you a few examples of that, the Mutilated Gentlemen's Corps operated along the basic assumption that most disabled veterans would be classed as useful. And so that was the label that they were given, and that they would support themselves entirely through work. And so only those with the most severe wounds would receive a pension to live off. Now that sounds fair until you look at what the categories consisted of. So the useful category was absolutely huge. So that included veterans with wounds between 11 and 90% disability. If you're wondering what that means, because these pictures are a little bit odd, 11% could be the loss of a middle finger, for example, while the amputation of an entire arm was only 80%. So you could have lost an entire arm or an entire leg and you were still expected to support yourself entirely through work. And that's different to, for example, the French legislation after the First World War, where it's more kind of graduated, where you might not receive a full pension if you're, you know, you're only 50% disabled, but you would receive something, whereas that's not the case in Spain. And then when people were considered wounded enough to receive a pension, those pensions were calculated according to rank. The incomes for the rank and file were actually pretty limited. So to give you a sense of that, a soldier received between 6,000 and 12,000 pesetas per year, and that was decided in 1938, but then the rates weren't changed until 1958. So over the years, that income really just kind of drops, and the kind of privilege that came from those material benefits in the 1930s, by the 1950s, really kind of starts to become eroded. And I should probably say that Francoism, like in Nazi Germany, like in fascist Italy, adopted a kind of pronatalist stance and introduced certain pronatalist policies. So disabled veterans were expected to have families. They were expected to support not only themselves, but their wife and children. And they, on the incomes that they were given, and on the it was often very difficult to support themselves and their families. And then also just another kind of thing to add to this, that those who were in work, if we look at what kinds of employment the disabled were helped to get, a lot of this work is very is unskilled work. It's poorly paid. It's work that, again, in that post-war period of extreme economic hardship, is a very real privilege. But then over the long term, there are no opportunities for career progression. There are few opportunities for job satisfaction. That, you know, these are employments that compensate for the career that a veteran might have had if he was never wounded in the first place. And then, just to add another little thing or element to this, is that we really need to think about the way that we're thinking about Francoism and or the kind of community of victors under Francoism. So the kind of the community of mutilated gentlemen is a really interesting insight into that, because you have, or you need to think about, or you have kind of two, this is just quite crude, but generally speaking, kind of two, I guess, strands of mutilated gentlemen. So you have those who continue to pursue military careers after the Civil War. So they remain as professional soldiers in active service. So again, if they're in active service, then they can benefit from those automatic promotions by seniority. So a lot of the veterans that, you know, even if they enter the army at quite a low rank in the Civil War, by the end of their lifespan, they could be promoted to colonels. And, you know, that is the case. And actually, if you were that kind of mutilated gentleman, then you did fairly well out of the system and you could live comfortably off that. But if you were kind of a civilian veteran, quote unquote, which is kind of bit of a strange term, but if you were just kind of conscripted into the army and then you left the army after the Civil War and you weren't part of the military establishment in that way, you really didn't experience that same kind of security as those military mutilated gentlemen did. So that there's really a kind of, I think when you're thinking about Francoist veterans and you really need to kind of think about what their backgrounds are and what kind of careers that they were pursuing in in the aftermath of the war, to really kind of get a sense of where they sat along those social hierarchies. So anyway, just to kind of be clear, Franco-Spain was in no way a utopia for disabled men, even on the winning side, and especially those in the rank and file.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. To serve others in ways that promote human flourishing and create a ripple effect of transformation for generations to come. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
You were talking about how veterans were classified
and how they sort of received benefits. So at this point in history, there was a general lack of knowledge about mental illnesses that were experienced by military veterans. Today, we call that post-traumatic stress disorder. Was this recognized in Spain at all during this period?
Again, yeah, that's a really great question. And So to even get into the mutilated gentleman's corps, even if you had been injured on the Francoist side, on the right side, for the dictatorship purposes, you could only access those limited benefits that came with membership of the corps if you managed to go through this kind of quite stringent application process where there was certain kind of eligibility criteria. And mental illness was kind of problematic in terms of that eligibility criteria. So it's quite complex, but long story short is that mental instability caused by physical injury, such as a blow to the head, was considered eligible for entry into the mutilated gentleman's corps, but those with psychological trauma were not granted entry into the corps and so didn't receive benefits. In terms of where that kind of comes from, it has a lot to do with the scientific tradition in which Spanish psychiatrists, or rather Francoist psychiatrists, were embedded. So German psychiatry was really influential to Francoist psychiatrists, like Antonio Berjo Nájera, who was the head of psychiatric services for the Francoist army during the Civil War. Just to give a sense of the relevance of that. So in the late 19th century, Hermann Oppenheim in Germany had introduced this traumatic neurosis diagnosis, which had enabled men with trauma-induced conditions to be recognized and to receive pensions. But then from around the time of the Great War, that diagnosis was falling increasingly out of favor and was becoming increasingly marginalized within German psychiatry. So, and essentially that the new kind of diagnosis that came into vogue was the hysteria diagnosis, which really situated responsibility for mental illness in the individual weakness of a particular soldier. So Vallejo Nájera, who, like I said, would go on to lead the psychiatric services on the Franco side during the Civil War, he was actually in Germany at the time that all of those discussions were happening. So he was part of Spain was neutral during the First World War, and he was part of an international commission inspecting POW camps. And so he witnessed all of those debates happening firsthand. I mean, Vallejo Nájera wasn't the only person or the only Spanish psychiatrist at the time that kind of followed that German tradition, but it really just helped to explain the Franco's regime's stance on mentally ill veterans. So coming back to the application process for entry into the Corps, part of the application process involved proving a link between your condition and your service in the war. But if the science at the time didn't acknowledge that link and didn't acknowledge that external factors such as war could cause trauma, then there was no way for an individual soldier to prove that there was a link between his mental illness and the war. And of course, this denial of that causal link was very useful for the regime, because it completely absolved it of any responsibility and saved the dictatorship a whole load of cash in disability payments. But having said all of that, there were some limited provisions for what the regime termed military lunatics. So that was the language used at the time, Spanish is dementes. So legally speaking, these lunatics were those who were experiencing mental instability caused by physical injury to the brain, or, and this is more interesting, people with endogenous conditions like schizophrenia, like psychosis or paranoia, as long as they'd served in the army at least 10 years. So of course that didn't apply to the vast majority of soldiers who just served during the period of the Civil War. So again, mental health provisions really reflect that kind of civilian military dichotomy within this cohort of disabled veterans, where those who remain close to the military establishment can benefit from that protection. And I don't want to overstate again the benefits that mentally ill veterans received, you know, the few who did, but proximity to the military establishment really did offer a little bit of protection there, in a way that civilian veterans, if you like, weren't kind of covered. And then another kind of aspect to all of this that we need to think about is that all of those discussions around war neurosis and all of the kind of legislation around military lunatics ignored men who returned from war with depression, with guilt, with conditions like alcohol abuse. And we can get a sense that people did suffer psychologically with those kinds of conditions from, if we look at psychiatric files, from temporary asylums, but also the writings of clinical psychiatrists like Carlos Castillo del Pino, who worked with not just veterans, but he wrote about some patients that he dealt with who had trouble dealing with difficult memories of the war. So we know that men were often deeply affected by their participation in the conflict, but we'll never know the full extent of the psychological fallout of the Spanish Civil War, unfortunately. But absolutely, there was certainly a lot of kind of mental instability resulting from the war, and there was a certain acknowledgement of that, both in terms of, you know, by psychiatrists who worked with directly with patients, but also on a kind of more popular level in literature. In particular, you can really get a sense that there is a general kind of awareness that there are some people who came back from the war changed. And a good example of that is Carmen Laforet's novel Nada, which includes a couple of characters who are mentally unstable, and she does make that connection between their service in the Civil War and their mental instability. So yeah, it's very difficult to quantify, and there are no statistics on it, but the problem existed.
Moroccan soldiers were seen as a critical part of the Spanish army in the years before the Civil War. How were they viewed within the context of the military and society? You know, were they thought of as anything close to equal? you know, how did their performance during the Civil War sort of maybe change what racism looked like in Spain?
Yeah, that's, again, a great question. And indeed, when we talk about Spanish Civil War veterans, we, especially on the Franco side, we really need to talk about Moroccans because they were such an important part of the Francoist armed forces. So partly because of their reputation as skilled fighters, but also undoubtedly because as colonial troops, they were seen as more expendable than Spanish troops. Moroccan regulars were often used as shock troops during the Civil War, so they often played a leading role in some of the key battles. So in terms of how they were viewed within the military, you know, they were known for, or they had this kind of reputation for their ferocity on the battlefield. But there was also this kind of element of colonial pride in the Moroccan regular troops. So Moroccan soldiers were certainly seen as racially inferior Spaniards, but Spanish officers had this kind of romantic view of the regulares as this kind of, you know, one of the last vestiges of Spain as an imperial power. So Spain lost its last American Pacific colonies in 1898, which becomes known simply as El Desastre, the disaster. So in that sense, the Moroccan protectorate is really this kind of part of Spain's sense that it is still a colonial power and still an important world power. And actually, there's still a lot of, I guess, kind of romanticism around the Moroccan regulars within the Spanish army. So there's, in the Spanish army, there are still troops which are called regulares, so the regulars. And even though they're mostly Spanish now, they still wear the old kind of traditional uniform of the Moroccan regulars, so the red caps and the white cloaks. I don't think there's been a discussion about cultural appropriation in the Spanish army yet. I sometimes wonder whether it's coming, but it'll be interesting when it happens. Throughout Francoism, the figure of the Moroccan Moor, to use the language of the time, is really important to kind of Francoist imperial prestige. Franco has his own Moorish guard, for example, made up of Moroccan troops. In terms of how they're viewed in society, that's quite complicated and it kind of depends. So there's general racism. So certain expressions like "Hay moros en la costa," there are Moors on the coast, which is kind of an expression to say that there's somebody dangerous or suspicious around, you need to be careful. And so there's those kinds of, I guess, like low level racism, I suppose. But then there's also a kind of more kind of positive side to things. So during the Civil War, a lot of Moroccan soldiers meet and form romantic attachments with Spanish women, for example. And I mean, that often happens when Moroccans are in Spanish hospitals and they're being treated by Spanish nurses. Of course, when the regime catches wind of this, they're really concerned about racial mixing. And a lot of these couples are quite sadly really prevented from seeing each other. A lot of their love letters are confiscated as a way of trying to separate them. But the fact that these relationships existed really give a sense of how more kind of positive relationships could be developed on the ground. And I'm sure they weren't free of those kinds of racial hierarchies, but it does present a slightly kind of different side of things there. But I'm not sure or how much empathy there was for Moroccan soldiers. And I should probably say that another side that I haven't mentioned is that Moroccans were really depicted as these rapacious savages, and Francoist generals, particularly Gonzalo Cebollano, was famous for this speech that he gave where he would talk about where he was kind of threatening the Republican side and saying that the Moroccans would come and slaughter the men and rape the women. This figure of the Moroccan Moor as this as these kind of barbarous characters was promoted on both sides, which I think, you know, probably served to preclude any kind of empathy for their sacrifices, really. In terms of policy, so during the war and post-war, there's certainly a sense that the regime needs to at least look like it's caring for its Moroccan troops. Disability provisions are a part of that. So Moroccan troops who become injured and become disabled are catered for within a Moroccan version of the Spanish Honourable Corps. But also, I mean, during the war, the Franco side goes out, kind of attempts to keep the troops docile by catering for their religious customs. So kind of special Muslim hospitals, which provide halal food. Moroccans are allowed to practice their religion freely during their time in the army, which is particularly striking when you think about the fact that the war is depicted as this Catholic crusade against the infidel. But there is that kind of that tolerance of the cultural practices of Moroccans there. But I mean, this kind of continues to an extent after the Civil War. So particularly after the Second World War, when Spain is isolated from its European neighbours because of its open support of the Axis, and the regime needs to find allies elsewhere. This kind of elsewhere includes the Arab world. So Spain continues to foster harmonious relationships with the protectorate. So, for example, it makes a big show of providing affordable housing and other kind of social measures in northern Morocco. So there is that kind of sense of paternalism, which remains beyond the Civil War and after the Second World War. But that kind of paternalism drops off over time, especially after independence in 1950.
You mentioned the sort of how Moroccan veterans are treated. I know that they create an honorable corps of the Moroccan War Mutilated, which has a Spanish name I'm not going to attempt. So, but we've also discussed earlier in this interview about how, you know, maybe the benefits that were provided to Spanish military veterans were not great. So how did what was provided for Moroccan war veterans kind of compare to that?
Yeah, so the Moroccan War Disabled, it's an interesting case because obviously they're recognised in a way that Republican veterans aren't, but the provisions for them are even more measly than they are for the Spanish rank and file. And really there was kind of little attempt to rehabilitate them for the workplace. So, you know, work was such a huge focus for Spanish disabled veterans and this idea that they would kind of reclaim their or maintain their masculine identities and their roles as breadwinners to their families through work. You just don't get the same kind of rhetoric or the same emphasis on that with Moroccans. Again, those who were gravely disabled but not disabled enough to attain the higher categories of disability are the ones that fare the worst, because they really kind of fall between the gaps in provisions there. After Moroccan independence in 56, the regime essentially kind of washes its hands of its responsibilities to that category and to those who it classified as useful. So that at that time, those veterans are either transferred to the Moroccan army or they receive a very small pension commensurate with their years of service, and that might not have been that many years. So, and then on top of that, you just really don't get the linguistic squeamishness, I suppose, that you get with Spanish veterans. So Moroccan War Disabled aren't mutilated gentlemen like Spaniards, and the regime has no qualms really of referring to them as invalids or as useless. So on the surface there is a core for Moroccan veterans and there are provisions there, but there are quite stark differences between the treatment of disabled Spaniards or disabled Francoist soldiers and Moroccans.
So outside of just war veterans, I know your current research kind of looks at the sexual abuse that occurred in Francoist Spain. And I think I've seen the phrase dishonest abuse. What does that mean? What is that research? Sort of what are you looking at right now?
Yeah, so I suppose so the work that I'm doing at the minute kind of follows on my interest of the body and how Spaniards experience the Civil War and Francoism through the body, through disability, through violence. So my research at the minute looks particularly at how women under Francoism experienced sexual violence and how sexual violence was dealt with in the courts, particularly how medical evidence was used by Francoism, by the Francoist courts in trials relating to sexual violence. Yeah, I mean, I'm still in the early stages of that research, but it's really quite interesting in the sense that I guess when I started out, I was expecting to see a lot of, I guess, politically motivated sexual violence, or, you know, sexual violence where in the courts, the political identities of the perpetrators and the victims formed a kind of important part of how those court processes develop. But as I've been doing the research, I think I've been getting a sense of the more kind of subtle ways in which Francoism and all the kind of disruption of the Civil War affected women's experiences, and not just women, but sexual violence in general. So in terms of kind of how women are dealt with in the courts, there's a lot of continuity with the way in which chastity and purity is regarded before the Civil War and before Francoism. But what you get under Francoism is, I guess, a hardening or kind of less leeway in terms of how women are treated, and not just women, but also children as well. So there's just in ideas of Catholicism and those kinds of, I guess, longer standing ideas of female chastity are certainly there, but they're exacerbated by the fact that a lot of the administrators that are in the courts or are less likely to give women the benefit of the doubt, or are, to put it differently, perhaps more willing to protect their military brothers or to protect their people who they are in cahoots with politically. So really that kind of harshening of attitudes towards victims, so kind of an increase in victim skepticism, I suppose, kind of comes because, I suppose, more because of the tighter connections between the men who are in power within those administrative roles, rather than because of, strictly speaking, kind of political motives, if that makes sense. But yeah, it's a really interesting project, and it's one that I'm really looking forward to getting back and getting back into the archives when I can to look into this more. But you really get the sense that because there is so much corruption within the Francoist courts, victims really really cling to medical evidence, and you know a lot of victims actually will go to the doctors before they even present a rape denunciation to the police, and they'll say to the doctors, can you examine me? And then they will go to the doctors and say, look, I have this doctor note that says I have been raped. And there is this kind of hope in the, I guess, objectivity of science there. But actually, often the victims are ultimately unsuccessful in their denunciations, because there will be further medical examinations ordered, and the people conducting those examinations will be very happy to follow the steer of the court, will be very happy to exploit the ambiguities of medical evidence. So, I mean, even now, medical evidence in rape trials is extremely ambiguous. And that was no less the case at the time. So yeah, it's something that it's a project that I'm still in the process of working on. But I think there, again, we'll see the kind of more subtle ways in which the regime, aside from all of the purging, all of the very kind of blatant repression, I think the project will see those kind of more subtle ways in which the regime shifted expectations of women, and also expectation or the ways in which justice was carried out on crimes that weren't strictly speaking related to the kind of political instability in Spain.
Thank you for coming and talking with me today about these topics.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been lovely.